Future Commerce is brought to you by Turn2. Turn2 provides customer content solutions with a roadmap for the future. Turn2 is proud to support this podcast to further the conversation on commerce innovation. Learn more at turn2networks.com/future-commerce. Future Commerce is brought to you by Link. Link makes your customers' post-purchase experience something they love through breakthrough innovation in artificial intelligence. Be sure to stick around to the middle of the show for a special offer. You can visit Link online today at letslink.com/podcast. That's letslink.com/podcast. Hello and welcome to Future Commerce, the podcast about cutting edge and next generation commerce. I'm Philip.
I'm Brian.
And today we are joined by our first repeat guest. Very excited to have her back with us. It's Saku Panditharatne from whereabouts are you these days, Saku?
I'm based in London.
Based in London. And we're just delighted to have her along for the ride. She's going to give us some hot takes, and some Saku's hot takes are one of my personal favorite things from Twitter. We also want your hot takes. So we want you to give us feedback about today's show. So make sure you leave that. You can place that on the discuss comment box on futurecommerce.fm. And you can subscribe right there as well. Link off to iTunes or Google Play. You can also listen right from your Amazon Echo on TuneIn Radio with the phrase Alexa Play Future Commerce Podcast. All right. Well, it's been a little while since we did a show like this. And in the time between our Magento Mage Talk Live event and in some of the interviews we've done with like Body Labs and Acquia and some of the other interesting guests that we've had on, a lot of things have happened. So we're going to try to pack a lot of content and news today in. But in the midst of this, the thing that I can't seem to get away from on social media these days is how many.
Just social media, man.
It's kind of everywhere. It's everywhere. Most I hear everybody. I'm starting to even hear it on NPR. That's when things from Reddit pop up on Facebook a few weeks later. When you're hearing it on NPR about retail crisis, you know it's kind of a thing that is going to happen, whether it's really happening or whether it's not really happening. People are now talking about it happening, and that I think makes it a thing. So because we're a very retail and commerce focused podcast, I'd love to kind of open today with sort of that. So hashtag retail crisis. Where are we, Brian?
Man, it's a lot going on. Like you mentioned, is it actually happening, or is it just sort of a thing that everyone's talking about? There's been, you know, obviously there's been a few retailers that have been declaring bankruptcy. So there's something going on. What we can attribute that to is a good question. Is it e-commerce? Is it Amazon? Is it Walmart on a crazy acquisition spree? I think there's a little bit of a let's see what happens, because I think I could make a case that e-commerce is making a big play. Amazon's stealing a lot of market share. People are purchasing there. But one of the things that really caught my eye was that Neiman Marcus came out and said that even their customers are looking for discounts on prices. And so that's a good indication that something is up with how people think about what they're purchasing. And if anything, that mindset shift is telling that, you know, something's going on in our economy or in retail or in technology. Yeah, something's happening.
Global economic. Yes. Saku, what's your take from London town?
So my take is, why is this happening now? Kind of in the back of my mind, I'd kind of assumed that, you know, physical retail was kind of doomed, and it was only a matter of time before they go the way of Blockbuster. But like, it just made me wonder, like, why, you know, this year was the tipping point for all these stores to start shutting down. I mean, part of it is, okay, you know, Amazon is expanding market share. But like, the other thing that made me kind of wonder about this is, I wonder if it's that what's happened since the financial crisis is that loads of unprofitable stores have just kind of been propped up by low interest rates. And now that they're starting to rise, I mean, obviously, like, you can't, you know, take all these correlations like this. You know, you can't correlate some random abstract thing in the economy with why all these stores are shutting. But it just does make me think, wonder if there's some kind of relation there. So I actually read a really interesting paper this week called Zombie Firms. And it's basically saying that about 10% of all the capital in our economy in both the UK and the US goes into basically firms which haven't made a profit in 10 years. So they're basically just like living off credit. And it shows they have all these like kind of effects on diffusion. So if you're an entrepreneur and then there's this you know, this sector you want to go into, but it's full of zombie firms, it's like the paper shows that it's like really tough for you to enter that because, you know, they'll be able to compete with you and it has all these like second order effects.
Sure.
So I just wonder if like that's related to what's happening in retail and like, you know, why did that happen now?
Yeah, I read something similar, but it was a few months ago. You know, I think my sort of my take there is that it's really a drag on more on productivity or like, you know, national or global productivity in that we don't really have people productive in a workforce. We don't have people productive, creating jobs and sort of benefiting the economy in general. And so it's sort of this, it's like a very slow death to, you know, it's, yeah, sort of existing there on the fringe of actual, I don't know. I have so many things I can't say all at one time. I'm trying to. It's tough to really understand how these retailers are feeling the brunt in traditional bricks and mortar. I think the obvious cause we all want to point to is Amazon or digital commerce. But most of these or many of these have had very successful digital commerce businesses and were also retailers through marketplaces themselves. And I think that, you know, while that can drain off of the bottom line, some of them were experiencing year-over-year increases in top line revenue. So there must be other increases in cost of doing business and cost of goods sold that I don't think we've realized just yet.
That's actually really interesting. I hadn't thought of that before. Actually, one thing that's interesting about one of the high-profile stores that shut down was BCBG.
Yeah.
And so the thing about them is, like, they're really inefficiently structured as an online business because I don't know if you guys know much about it. Probably not customers, but I am. So basically, they have, like, a mainstream fashion line, and then they have all these evening dresses, and what they're known for is evening dresses. So if you're a girl and you're going to get a prom dress, that's where you go. And so if you go into a store, that's okay because, you know, you go in there for your prom dress and end up picking up a bunch of stuff along the way. But if you go on there, but when you're on an online store, the browsing factor is reduced. So you end up just buying the thing you went there to get. So you just get the dress. So what BCBG has ended up in is they're in this situation where they have like this kind of like appendage business, their regular clothes. And that just makes it really inefficient to operate. And so that's kind of why they're closing. So that's kind of why the shift to retail might cause you to have to shut down and just restructure, because sometimes your entire brand is just like not suitable for online, but it was okay.
But I also wonder if it's not a sort of a failure of just a heightened or increased demand from customers for diversity and product offering across a variety of price points. Even I think Brian mentioned it a minute ago, which is Neiman Marcus shoppers becoming more price conscious. I think it's more about, you know, instead of having a flagship retail store like BCBG, you know, on Fifth Avenue, where they carry everything, and then your satellite stores having, you know, 50, 60 of the main line or a particular season, in stock. I think we've come to sort of expect that we have the, you know, let's call it the Walmart experience, but you know, every single thing that I could want would be available at every retail storefront when I visit it. And which is what I'm being told the exact opposite when I speak to a merchant directly. They say that they want more digital experiences in store. Their consumers are asking for more digital experiences, or asking for, you know, more tactile, the Tory Burch sitting on a leather couch, you know, trying on shoes and buying a handbag and feeling like you're in your living room. But that's not, it doesn't seem like the ones that are struggling, also seem to have a good mix of the sort of sparse retail experience. H.H. Gregg is one that comes to mind. They're a big box store, but they were sort of set up into these, you know, smaller, more compartmentalized stores within stores that had more retail experience or experiential retail. So it's interesting. It sort of flies in the face of the things that we say that the consumer wants now. Go ahead.
Yeah. So let me kind of throw another sort of theory in there, I guess. So interestingly enough, this gets back to another concept. This theory gets back to another concept we've talked about before, which is passive commerce. Mm-hmm. I can't help, and this is just based on my personal shopping habits, and I feel like I might fall out of the norm on on that front. But with all of the deal sites, RetailMeNot, Deal News, Slick Deals, and so on, I can't help but think that now, you know, the average consumer knows about all these sites. I think maybe one of the things that's happening right now is people expect to get a percentage off, because when you shop online, you expect to get a deal. I can't help but think that technology is simply driving people towards, wow, I can wait on this. And there's such an oversupply too. That's another thing. If you look at some of these stores, a lot of them have crazy discounts. I mean, my wife and I, you know, we go to the Limited and we never buy something at full price because their clearance racks were packed. Pennies, another insane amount of discounts that happened there. I think a lot of the shoppers there just weren't buying things at full price. The kind of shoppers that they were, that was sort of the lower end of the market. And so those people are going to wait. And so they're going to, you know, they're not going to buy anything at full price. They're going to wait till, and then the discounts end up being like absolutely crazy.
And we're also in that place too, Brian, where we've trained the consumer in that way, right? That's
exactly,
you know, JCPenney went for price transparency and it almost killed their business entirely. Well, I guess 138 stores closing is killing their business to some degree.
Yeah. And so I feel like it's this weird spot of like pretty much any style I can think of at any quality level is going to come down in price. Neiman Marcus last call. I bought stuff on there and I've been able to get top shelf brands for like gap prices or less. And so, the reality is I can find clothes that make me look good, that I'm happy with, that are brands that I like, for prices that if I wait and I set up, you know, price monitoring, or I just, you know, I just do a certain amount of monitoring myself, I'll be transparent. I don't buy a pair of shoes for more than, you know, 30, 40 bucks because I can get the brands that I want and that I like for that price, even though their listing prices are, you know, over $100. And so, I think it's a scenario where maybe actually brands need to be really careful about what their supply looks like and how they go about discounting. I'm not saying that they don't discount, but I think maybe pricing strategies right now are just, I don't know if people are thinking about this in that context or not.
I also think there's this thing where, you know, the average age of someone who goes into new markets is like 54.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's like they just have like this kind of aging population who's like spending, you know, like less and less consumption. Like, you know, just like disposable income is a smaller and smaller share of their budget. So, you know, they kind of want to spend less. And then you've got your young people who just go online, or either they go online or they just, you know, have less money than people did 20 years ago. So they have less disposable income. So, Actually, one interesting thing is Neiman Marcus actually got Rent the Runway as a feature in their stores to get young people to just walk through the store in hope, because they just don't go there now. So the hope is they'll like go there and then see some stuff and then buy something which isn't discounted. But I mean, I'm not sure if like that kind of attempt to make people behave in what was an irrational way is ever going to work again. Because like once you know that you can get stuff at a discount, is luring people into the store to tempt them going to help? I mean, I'm not sure.
Yeah, I totally agree. Mm-hmm. Totally agree. I think it's a really good point.
But maybe it's different strategies. It can't entirely be based on price. I think it has more to do with our perception of value. You know, my understanding would be that I don't know that I have a higher perceived value on, you know, a shoe of a particular brand so much as I have a value on, you know, my need for a brown shoe and it to look a certain way, or fit my style in a certain way. I'm becoming less brand conscious, and maybe that's, you know, maybe I'm the worst barometer for, you know, the American consumer.
No, I think that's a really good point. No, you're nailing it right now. Yeah. Like brand doesn't really matter. It's all about quality, fit, and look.
Yeah.
And people like it's just not as important. And then, you know, if you look at a lot of these brands like Abercrombie and Wet Seal and Unlimited, they all had a very specific feel to them.
Well, you kind of, yeah, exactly. I mean, with the exception of, you can actually, if you want to go down the list a bit, of 2017 retail store closings, and this is from businessinsider.com, but in the top 20, 50% of these look like they're all, you know, sort of fashion retailers. You've got Wet Seal, Bebe, Crocs, well, let's not dwell on Crocs, but anyway. Crocs, JCPenney, BCBG, American Apparel, Kmart. You know, to some degree,
let's not dwell on American Apparel either. I don't know if that had anything to do
with it. But the thing with some of these is it's disposable fashion, right? Some of these are, it's not fashion. It's, you know, it's not like it's high fashion to some degree. But with the Limited and the others, it also feels like there might be something that's just changing as a culture in our expectation of what, you know, maybe, you know, work, you know, I don't know, work dress expectation. I don't know where I'm going with that, but
actually, no, I think you're getting it. Go ahead, Saka. Sorry.
Yeah. Well, actually, I think so. One thing that's kind of interesting is like the idea of a lifestyle brand that was something which was invented in the 90s, and I mean, like I think that still has a future. Like Nasty Gal is like a new invention, and you know, I mean, even though they've gone bankrupt for kind of unrelated reasons, that seems like still kind of something which is on the ascendant in the culture. So I'm not sure a cultural expectation makes that much sense, because it seems like people still you can still create value by, you know, telling a story about this is a lifestyle, this brand represents that lifestyle. So I just kind of think that it's more a case of just inefficiency. Like, how long were you able to get away with that kind of inefficiency? And it turns out in 2017, you know, that's not okay anymore. It's this kind of creative destruction we're having.
Without going too deep into it, how much of this do you think is opportunistic? Like, if you're going to follow me here because this is a stretch, but if you're going to, if you're ever going to close retail stores and you're ever going to sort of own up to the debt you're amassing, wouldn't this be the best time to do it when we're kind of at the precipice of the markets, where, you know, regression to the mean is all but certain at any minute. You know, we have, you know, the first 100 days of a Trump presidency, massive deglobalization talk, a lot of, you know, like really interesting time, right? And wouldn't this be the time to do it sort of now to get it out of the way?
I'm not sure about that. Wouldn't you just wait until the crisis actually hits and then?
I think the crisis is here, right?
My feeling is that they were already like living on borrowed time and like now it's finally hit the fan.
I agree with Sacco on this. I don't think it was a opportunistic moment for them.
you don't think the dam broke with the limited. It's interesting. I feel like there was a chain reaction here. I should look into that.
Well, like what would have started the chain reaction? So you have like global instability, and well, the thing is, you have like a market rally now. So I don't know. I think kind of that kind of suggests that people are expecting just more gridlock and nothing much in the political front. I don't know. It's kind of hard to tell. I don't think I've seen anyone come up with a cohesive theory of like the relationship between like the stock market and politics right now. So
I think also like if you look at Macy's, they're not declaring bankruptcy, but they're having troubles. I think that that's a good indication that this isn't like an opportunistic chain reaction. I think it's a, it's a real issue.
Perhaps it's just one of those, you know, I had this interesting conversation about the prevalence of flagship stores in, you know, first rate shopping malls. And they're the keystone. When flagship stores and large retailers like Sears or Macy's departs, you know, it doesn't matter how great the brands are inside, they tend to wither over time. I think the smaller retail chains, especially in the fashion world, sort of thrive on the traffic that's created by the larger keystone brands. And so their borrowed time is their lifeline is only as long as, you know, Sears can hold out in its, you know, new strategy this week to sell, you know.
I can totally believe that, like, all the small stores are closing because the big stores are closing. Like, have you seen what's happened with Starbucks? Like, they're suffering lowered foot traffic. And, you know, that's why they're doing the high-end, like, coffee thing. To kind of save from the fact people don't go to malls anymore. So, yeah.
Yeah, that's a good... I'd like to pull on that thread for a minute. You would think that, so there's a great example of sort of digital transformation in a business. They've done a lot in the last 18 months to bring more digital enablement to their retail stores. It's not just order online. You know, they have they had a whole voice commerce bot enabled coffee ordering. They've done a lot of really sort of very public consumer facing tech. I feel like that should be if it should work for any brand, that should be what aspirationally what every brand should be working toward is bringing a sense of digital enablement to customers, and it's not working for them. And that's sort of scary.
I think we just live in like very crazy and interesting times. Like, I saw a really good interview with Eric Schmidt of Google on YouTube a couple of days ago, and he was just saying, and it was like him talking to Peter Thiel, and then Peter Thiel was saying, "Oh, Google, what you have like, you know, billions of dollars stored in cash, and you don't know what to do with it." And he's like, why aren't you going and, you know, building more stuff? Why isn't Google expanding? What are you doing? Why are you sitting on this all this cash?" And then he replies that that the three things holding them back are talent, regulation, and then also real estate. So it's because, you know, rent is too expensive in the Bay Area, you can't get people to move here. So it's just like this kind of weird thing where there's all this kind of stuff preventing new stuff from emerging. And so it just seems that's kind of related to the stuff we've seen in the wider economy, where you have very low interest rates, kind of high unemployment. So that means you have like a surplus of both capital and labor. And so the limiting thing is like, building institutions to put that to use. And so this is when we come to like digitization of retail and digitization of Starbucks or whatever. I mean, like the opportunity is there, but like, the execution and just isn't, which is, I think, a very strange kind of situation to be in, right?
Mm.
If you believe the rest of the argument.
Yeah, I think a while back we referred to an article from Greylock, and they were like, just give us something to invest in.
It was
like this weird call, like broad call to people, mm-hmm. like, please, we want to invest, but we don't see anything that's really coming together. Like, we know the tech is there to do something with. Please do something with it.
Actually, I had someone say to me, to describe the state that we're in, he's like, the 20th century worked and, you know, made a lot of people rich. But now it's kind of run its course. Like, we can no longer make incremental improvements in the kind of paradigm that we had then. We can no longer just build faster roads, bigger shopping malls. So we kind of need to like invent a new kind of paradigm for growth. And that's just kind of struggling to be born right now. And in some ways, we're kind of like running up against the limits of the old system. Like, it's especially true with like all the stuff you see in real estate, where you have, you know, housing regulation driving up rents in all the major cities. So people can't live there and get weather jobs there. So that's like, I think, one of the most egregious examples of this. It's just kind of like a very strange situation, I think.
Yeah, I think I'm really happy you brought up real estate, because like my mind's just been like, I want to get back to real estate. You mentioned real estate. And I think, you look at what's happening with the malls and other, like, you know, it's not just malls, but like space in America in general. If we start to see major corporations start to pull out of spaces, mm-hmm. What's that going to do to communities and real estate in general? But on the other side, you know, you have, I think there is a big switch coming. You mentioned having to sort of reorganize, and with the advent of the mobile workforce, I think there could be great opportunities for businesses to do the exact opposite of what IBM just did.
Right.
And it's just, and actually incent people to work remotely, and train people how to be attached to each other, like to properly communicate and work in a remote capacity. And I think that is absolutely doable. I work remotely right now. I've worked remotely in the past, and it's something that's, it's a different experience than working in an office. But if you do it right, it can be extremely effective. You don't have to commute, and you can live somewhere that's more affordable than the probably major metropolitan area that your company is based in. And so I can see a huge opportunity here for one, companies to build out better systems for mobile workforces, which I know is happening already. I think Robert Scoble might be involved in one of those.
which we say nice things about Scoble, because we are trying to, he's given us a soft commitment to come on the show. So,
actually, I just talked to him today.
Yeah.
So I think he's coming on.
Yeah, we like having people like Robert on. So,
yeah, totally. Yeah. And I think it's a really good move for him to be involved in that right now, because I think,
I mean, we're on the way up. He's got to get in on the ground floor. Future Commerce is brought to you by Turn2. Turn2 is the fastest growing customer content platform provider to the Internet Retailer 500. They provide innovative ratings and reviews and visual reviews to the largest companies in the world, and they're backed by the highest customer service rating in the business. You can find out more today at turn2networks.com/futurecommerce. Link is the best way to get your customers coming back to buy again. Link's Cortex AI platform creates rich relationships with every customer at every touch point on every platform. From Magento to Shopify, Hybris and Demandware, over 300 logistic and reverse logistic carriers around the world are integrated with Link. Link brings your brand to where customers are on Facebook Messenger, Alexa, SMS, and more. Let Link add the power of artificial intelligence to your business. For a limited time, Future Commerce listeners can claim an exclusive trial offer for 30 days free of Link Cortex. Sign up today and visit them online at letslink.com/podcast. That's letslink.com/podcast.
actually, I would love to see some some incentives put in place for remote workforces.
Yeah.
Because think about this. If we put incentives in place for companies to have mobile workforces, one, it would reduce congestion on our roadways. Two, it would give people opportunities to not spend all of their money on housing. Three, it would give people a lot of time back. And four, it would, I think, start ushering in a new generation of workers, a new way of working. So, okay. and it would reduce pollution.
Okay, but before you have like a huge incentive, companies already have a huge incentive to do mobile working. It's just clearly not high enough. Like, you know, people prefer to work remotely and not spend all that time commuting and live in the cheap area. And like, it costs them a huge amount of money to be close to their workplace. And that's like a massive incentive for the companies to allow remote work, but yet it hasn't happened. Mm. Why is that?
Why is that? That's a good question. I think that's a question that would be worth pursuing further.
Yeah. I mean, go ahead.
Oh, okay. I just want to talk about this book that I read, which I'm telling everyone to read, which I think kind of explains like the kind of economic situation we're in now. I mean, it's called A Great Leap Forward by Alexander Field. So it's like this book about how, contrary to popular opinion, the 1930s were the most technologically advanced decade of the 20th century. So it had the highest productivity growth. Most people were, it was like tragic levels of unemployment, but you had very high levels of employment in industry R&D. So people working in petrochemicals, in manufacturing, and like the electrification of factories, they kind of perfected the assembly line, all this kind of stuff. And also they were building roads, they were building everything which made like the shopping mall, suburban kind of world possible. It's basically this kind of revisionist theory that like what fixed the depression was not, the war, but it was in fact, scientists working for 10 years to kind of invent this kind of new paradigm. The parallel today would be like, okay, there are like tons of people working in all kinds of different types of technology. We have new improvements in transport. Maybe self-driving cars will be important somehow later. We have the internet. We still haven't really seen the productivity gains from mobile diffuse into the rest of the workforce. So you don't have like your average company using Slack and mobile apps to communicate, and you don't have them restructured because of that. Mm. I think there's like all this kind of stuff, which is just like, we're on the verge of it happening, but it's not for some reason. So maybe we need to have more waves of creative destruction, like what's happened in retail, for it to actually be a thing. But I'm not quite sure.
Yeah, actually, that's a really good point. Like all of the stuff that's happening in retail, like it, there's a lot of doom and gloom associated with it, but maybe it's a really good thing. I mean, I mean that in the best possible way. I don't like people losing their jobs, but I'm hoping that, we'll find ways to employ them that are actually better. and that we're the companies that are not keeping up and innovating are going to be the ones that sort of go by the wayside, and that might be okay.
Yeah. I mean, I think one of the big puzzles that we've seen I've seen on Econ Twitter anyways, you have like some firms have, 5% productivity growth. And it's like really high. Like they're innovating at this like crazy pace if you're in the top 5 or 10% of firms. And everyone else is just kind of lagging. And, why is that? Is it because one theory is they're in a different region and they're not copying the cutting edge techniques effectively, because it's happening far away. And the other theory is that there's just not enough creative destruction happening. Like, big companies have found a way to like kind of entrench themselves so they just kind of don't die. And then, no one can compete with them. So you just kind of have this stasis, which is bad because it means, no one's innovating. Hmm. So I think...
Keep going.
No, I'm just saying it's probably like a blend of both of those, or maybe something else differently. But I think that's kind of like the most interesting question to me, and in terms of like, what's happening in the economy. So
yeah, I just heard someone say recently, sort of ironically, that that person was really successful doing it that way, so they must know what they're doing. And right. So That's I don't agree with that philosophy. I think, you know, just because something worked in a certain period, even if that period was 5 years ago, doesn't mean that it's going to work again. And that I think, you know, companies need to be preparing for change. They need to be, we're in a state of rapid change, the likes of which we've never seen, except for maybe in the 1930s, according to this book. but I think basically what we're experiencing right now is the businesses that are setting themselves up for what's next, and they have an open mind and they're flexible. And actually, I heard that is an extremely common theme from people that I really respect, that businesses need to be setting themselves up to have structures in place that are conducive to change. So it's not that you don't have structures, but that you have structures where you can be flexible and get, you know, adopt what's next. Hmm. Hence open source.
Right. Totally. Yeah. And it's, I don't know. So, yeah, and also like one thing is just like the spread of just like organizational economics. So like the fact that, you know, you still have people who kind of, you know, go to offices where it's still, they still kind of act the same way that they would in like the 90s. Like there hasn't been that much like organizational change is kind of strange to me. It might be that, you know, it's like startups are the new way of doing things, and it's like very geographically concentrated, so this kind of techniques can spread, but I'm not exactly sure what it is. But
yeah, that's an interesting point too. I don't know. I think that we're seeing more industries sort of adapt to sort of, I don't know, the more manufacturing based approaches. We're seeing more innovation now than ever before in across different industries other than you know, just hard goods. We're seeing just in time manufacturing hitting everything from textiles to and soft goods to even to digital you know, to digital product development. And I'm not totally convinced. I mean, I'm not totally convinced that the entirety of our economy weighs on, you know, a 5,000, you know, low paying service jobs at a Macy's. But I do think that it sort of has a sort of a, it sort of tells a dark tale that these retailers, which ostensibly operate on incredibly low margins to begin with, because of all of the reasons that Brian extolled earlier, you know, the business, not everybody can be Amazon and hang in 20, 21 years with zero margins and sort of be propped up by continued investment and sort of this long-term payoff that may come one day. Amazon's kind of the...
But actually, I would disagree with that. I think you can. I think if you actually know, you have a good idea to be a retailer, you can just get capital to prop you up for ages. You know, because, you know, capital is basically free. If you have a good business, you can do that. It's just, yeah. Actually, so I think one interesting thing to think about is incremental versus paradigm shift improvements. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I think what we've become used to is growth coming from like incremental improvements. Like, you know, every year the car gets 5% faster, or like, you know, the plane gets, you know, 10% lighter. And so, you know, you don't really have to change the way society functions. You can just get growth just from people making incremental improvements in various industries. But I think, like, you know, that kind of ran its course. And then now we have to find something new. So it's like, I feel like what we have now is just like this kind of decade of experimentation in science and in industry. And we're kind of like figuring out what models work. And then I think we've already figured out what works. And it's now a question of like diffusion and implementation, installation. But I mean, that's just my theory.
Yeah, I agree with that in many ways. Like one of the things that we talked about in our prediction show for this year is this idea of convergence, which is a term that's not really a term, but it's the idea is tech. We've got a lot of different disparate texts that have come a long way, mm-hmm. but they need to be applied together in a first mover sort of way. and so retailers are going to have to find ways to apply this tech in a way that's never been done before. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's going to happen on sort of a small scale, and they're going to have to be okay with some of that failing. I think that's one of the things is like a lot of these businesses are not okay with a strategy flopping, like right. investing in something that's just, it's actually legitimate tech onto itself because that's the only way that they're going to be able to actually apply the new technology that's available, the baseline technologies. So like we talked with Body Labs mm-hmm. Just a couple episodes ago, and they have an unbelievable piece of tech right now where they can map a human body using AI with a 2D picture, one 2D picture of someone's, you know, a full body shot. They can give body data on their entire body using AI. And it's almost as close, it's almost as accurate as laser scans. Mind blowing.
Mm-hmm. Right. That
technology is something that could fundamentally change fashion and other industries. Mm-hmm. But it has to be applied. And so those companies that need to start looking out at things that didn't seem possible before, but actually are just becoming possible in an affordable way, and actually be ready to apply those pieces of technology with other things that they're already doing. And that's scary. That's scary.
I would disagree vehemently to say that, you know, a current generation, a current existing retailer is going to be able to adopt technology to somehow compete to consumer demands changing. I think like we couldn't have envisioned Facebook 20 years ago or even the iPhone, which are the two worst examples the only ones I could think of. But in the way that we couldn't even fathom what that would do to our society and to our lives and affect elections and all the rest. I don't know that commerce the way that it exists today has any parallel to what will exist 10 years from now, because the experiences that will be built in virtual reality or augmented reality will be unique to themselves and not an old retailer creating different versions of their existing brands in those spaces.
Sure. I don't disagree with that. I think I'm saying that they need to, like, those businesses need to figure out how to apply those technologies. It doesn't have to be applying their current existing model to them. They might need to go spin out some additional brands or try things that are way outside the scope of what they're doing right now. In fact, I think at NRF, the Big Show, just this past year, Richard Branson basically said this exact thing. These big brands need to think like they're entrepreneurs and start, you know, spinning out things that they wouldn't have ever thought that they would spin out.
Yeah. I mean, it's kind of tough to think of examples of, you know, legacy companies that actually did adapt to the new way of doing things. I mean, I would say like, you know, you've got like Kodak, which is like a famous example of like missing the boat. I don't know. Actually, one interesting example of a retailer, I guess, that adapted to the digital economy is Domino's. Have you guys heard the story? It's like so crazy. So basically, what happened is like their original Domino's plant, like business model, was all based around real estate. You had to have like the pizza place in the center of town so that people would go to it, and then, you know, just by being in the right place, you get enough customers to be sustainable. But after online ordering became a thing, that was no longer the edge it once was. So then the Domino's CEO was like, okay, we have to rethink our whole strategy. And so you just put like tons of effort into just like making the pizza better. And then they also perfected their online experience. They were like, okay, delivery in 10, 20 minutes or less or something like that. And then like their stock has gone up more than Apple has in like the last like 5 years.
They've dominated the pizza industry. It's crazy.
Right. Yeah, but that's a testament to transparency and supply chain and ubiquity of the brand and a lot of things that wouldn't have made anyone else successful but helped Domino's. But I agree with you.
And voice ordering. I mean, come on now.
But I mean, yeah, I mean, just in that case, it was just pretty amazing that they did pull it off because, yeah. You know, if your whole business model is based around one thing and then you kind of have to keep that going whilst you switch to something completely different. I mean, I can't imagine that's often a successful strategy.
Yeah,
it's such a great
example, actually, Saku. That's a phenomenal example because it sort of illustrates the other thing that we were saying, which is just because Domino's proved that could be successful doesn't mean that, you know, Sal's Ristorante in West Palm Beach is going to be successful with online ordering, even though their site continues to still have a worm or some sort of virus affecting it like 3 years later on some old version of Drupal. The webmaster, Kathy, her email is very prominently displayed there. We could all email her and find out why we still don't have online ordering. But I don't know that that's, you know, I think we have very low expectations for, you know, brands that we don't identify. Like we have a higher expectation on a Domino's than we do on Sal's, for instance. And I don't know that what makes Domino's successful will help Sal's, but it could help other businesses of similar size or shape to make that transition.
Or inform them on like how to compete like Mod Pizza. Like I think Mod is the other one that's just like blowing up, but they have a completely different model. It's almost a different food actually.
Right. Just-in-time pizza would be great if we could somehow outfit, you know, Ubers with pizza ovens and they could just, you know, show up. But that's transformative, right? I mean, that's
happening.
Yeah.
Uber Eats.
Just so you know.
do they prepare the food in Uber Eats? I feel like it's delivery, right?
No. Not Uber, but there are pizza trucks that are going to be cooking pizzas along the way. So there you go.
Yeah. Well, not to take too much of a side journey, but that does kind of touch on what you were talking about earlier with real estate, which is, you know, CVS has announced that they're sort of experimenting with the idea of, you know, autonomous, brand staple items being driven around in autonomous cars and sort of available to you at, you know, given times. So like pop-up shops, but for CVS and, you know, a roaming vehicle, autonomous roaming vehicle may become the real estate of the future. I mean, real estate doesn't have to be fixed in one place anymore, especially when a vehicle can be wherever you desire it to be.
Or you have a giant floating warehouse.
Yeah. Or
Amazon.
Dirigibles.
I don't know.
Yeah.
Amazon.
I find it interesting that, you know, the idea of the retail experience doesn't have to be fixed in one location like a mall. It could be mobile and come to us. And maybe that's more transformative than, you know, AR in the store.
Yeah. It might be weird that the layout of cities in the future is like, you know, you have really densely packed housing and workplaces, and then all your services are just in like these warehouses kind of in the suburbs, and they're kind of driven to you in self-driving cars or something. I can totally see like Manhattan being like that. It's just like this grid densely packed with people. And then you have like, I don't know, warehouses surrounding it. That's
roaming.
I mean, you know, that's kind of where so this whole like cities housing thing has interested me for a really long time, because it seems like one of the limits to our growth right now is people can't live near each other, so they don't have access to the best jobs. So, but then I read something that somewhere like this year, rents in all the major cities have started falling. And then they were connecting that to, okay, people are building housing, but also there are fewer 25-year-olds than there were 5 years ago. So that made me think that maybe we were actually kind of wrong about this whole cities being tied to productivity growth thing. Maybe it was just like, you know, the millennial youth boom moving into the cities that drove the rents up. And, you know, and we kind of just like made whole narrative about it, which I would love that to be true, but I'm not sure it is.
I'm not sure that it is either, but we have talked about communities and like the next wave of what a community will look like on the show. And one of the things we talked about is sort of open sourcing a blueprints for like technical focused communities, or I'm sorry, like
Stepford,
like more future focused yeah. communities. I haven't actually gone and looked it up to see if there's anything like that yet, but I am really excited to see what home build. I think you've touched on something that's important, which is this large shift that needs to happen. Like, we've been doing home building the same way for a long time. And so, there's been a lot of community building out here in the Northwest. It actually hasn't been that different from what happened in the 90s. It's a little better, but it's incremental. It's not transformative. And I would love to see, you know, and instead of Alphabet going out and building an entire city, I would love to see them build a bunch of micro communities that are tech focused and really optimized for what we have available.
So one thing that's interesting is, like, I read this paper, which is like, the best way to create a booming economy in like a random place is to build a university there. But it's obviously not the university that's the effect. It's the fact you have like crystallized, institutionalized knowledge in that particular region. So I just wonder if you could have this, like charter city experiment where you say, okay, I'm going to take this random piece of land in Nevada. I'm going to put like the ultimate drone institute research here. I'm going to pay every top drone researcher to move here. I'm going to make it so that like everything drone related here is completely legal. And there's like an initial seed market. And like, then you've kind of created this city, which is like, it's like a slice of the future. It's just, optimized to do one thing.
Yeah.
Like kind of Hollywood for drones. I don't know. So I wonder if that's kind of like.
Yeah. I mean, so what if instead of doing like something quite that grand, what if we just did that exact thing with communities throughout the US? Instead of centralizing it again, we made it micro. Like a more micro version of that, and it was spread out everywhere. I think that would be a lot more achievable, like building a small, few hundred housing, few hundred houses type communities or units or whatever they are, and doing some really like out of the box stuff with that, like, having the houses self-built by robots.
Here it comes. Or, yeah, I knew it. I knew you were going to go like to some crazy degree.
Oh, I think like that's not an efficient use of robots.
It's not an efficient use of robots. I agree with that
100%. Well, we're all living in the robots while we're building houses with the robots.
Yeah, sure, sure, exactly. Well, let's not get that crazy. Let's just talk about efficiently built houses that are set up to actually interact with the technology that we have and are set up to interact with the technology that's coming.
Yeah.
AKA augmented reality, having, shared workspaces that are built around augmented reality or mixed reality. I think that would be really cool.
I think it's interesting because real estate sort of adapts over time and is retrofitted with, whatever the latest and greatest is, electrical, plumbing, AR. I think, real estate will continue, to be what it is, and we'll adapt it and to fit. I'm really interested in, just to kind of wrap up this particular piece, but I'm sort of interested in the idea of somebody, coming along and sort of designing and open sourcing never mind a community, but just how to make more energy efficient homes available for a lower cost and sort of make housing more affordable from the total cost of ownership over the lifetime. I think we saw that that played out really, really well in the car, in sort of the electric vehicle, and we were seeing that in some other spaces where patents are sort of being open sourced, and I'd like to sort of see that continued innovation, but I'm not, we're getting a little off the topic here.
So it's just kind of weird to me. Okay. Like, it is kind of a cool idea, but like, why are we building smaller homes? Like, shouldn't, like, that's like so deflationary. I feel like, you know, really, like, it should be like, how can we get like bigger and better homes for everyone? And I think it's just like the kind of a symptom of the kind of, you know, kind of bad economic situation that we're in, that people can't think of like, okay, you know, here's a way for there to be more stuff. It's just kind of like scaling down, cutting back. I just kind of feel like, you know, I mean, maybe it's cool to have like flexible communities where the cost of living is low, but, you know, that kind of assumes that we're going to have like very low growth forever, and we're always going to need to be like scrimping and saving in that kind of way. I don't know. Mm-hmm.
I think that you're touching on something that gets back to our original conversation, which is our generation, like, and we're at the top end of this, has been through a very difficult economic period, mm-hmm. and our mindsets is, and we also, I mean, and then, and this is fairly specific to America, I think, or Western society. You know, the 90s were a very opulent time, and there was a lot of like, bigger is better. And, you know, coming out of that culture and sort of kicking back and saying, well, hold on, like, maybe it's not better. and then going through the economic period that we went through, changing people's mindsets around this to, you know, kind of go to the direction you just talked about, which is like, hey, wait, hold on. What if we can grow things at an incremental rate that's a lot faster than we thought? What if we can get bigger and better, what if this technology stuff that we've got is actually going to help us live larger lives and that are more efficient and more enjoyable? what about that idea? I think getting people to think like that have just been through what we've been through is going to be hard.
I don't think you have to actually, not to keep making these 1930s comparisons, but you know, this was kind of the same thing that happened. You didn't have another equity bubble from 1929 until 1960. People were like terrified. The spending rates were lower even after the depression ended. And I don't know. I think it's kind of, you know, I don't attempt to change it. I mean, maybe it's a good thing that people aren't going to have that kind of manic consumerism that we had, you know, before 2008. But I just kind of think that if you're trying to be objective and make predictions about the future, perhaps maybe be aware of that kind of bias, perhaps.
Mm. I mean, that's a good call.
Yeah, I could be wrong. Maybe we are actually all doomed and we should live in tiny houses or whatever. I like to think that's not true.
Yeah. Coming to the History Channel, we're all doomed and we all live in tiny houses. I do think that's interesting.
There's a few listeners that are going to like that statement.
Yeah, I think so. I think so as well. Well, I'm the one who said it, so they won't like it. If you said it, they would like it.
Maybe that's true.
I think there's an interesting sort of wrap up, which is, you know, I don't think I care or even think about the technology that sort of is pervasive in my life. As long as I feel like I'm enjoying and am satisfied with my life. And I think the thing I'm trying to get at, which is, you know, coming back to retail crisis, which is, I don't know that people are unhappy with the level of retail and consume, like, that, you know, I don't think they're unhappy with their purchases or their ability to get the goods and services that they require. I think the consumer satisfaction is telling a pretty decent story that they're happy to get that from the most convenient place possible so they can continue enjoying their lives, and that slogging to the mall and fighting crowds and having to worry about parking and all the rest is not an enjoyable experience. And so that's changing. And I don't know that it's a bad thing. Reclaiming some of that space that's being used for parking, you know, all over our suburbs and cities for other purposes is a bigger picture thought to say that we can do better. And having to herd people through and parade people through these, you know, edifices to consumerism is maybe not the best use of our space here on this planet.
Well, and I think you touched on something that I didn't think about as well, which is basically, in some ways, yeah, we're perfectly happy as consumers. Maybe we just don't need those brands. Like, reality is, I'm not going to miss any of those brands at all. I'm not going to care one lick if they're still around. From like a very like satisfaction of my life standpoint. And so maybe we've over-branded. These additional brands are just not necessary. And so I don't know. That's another thought as well.
or do you mean like there's limits to consumption in general, or just like these brands are crap and we're not gonna miss
that's
them?
That's what Brian said.
That's exactly what I said.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. I mean, I don't know that the Radio Shack was a bad brand. I personally, as someone who's sort of like a tinkerer, I spending, a good portion of my youth buying, radio parts and pieces of odds and ends to sort of, make things. It was nice to have a local store to get that and have someone at the store to sort of ask questions to and bounce ideas off of and bring in the part that I'm working on to see if they could take a look. And, that was a unique experience to that particular store. And something that I'll miss, now I have to go on a parts catalog somewhere, type in, they have literally 20 million parts. I don't know which one is better than the next. I can't take anything to anybody, and I can only type to a chat bot. It's not the same experience.
Sounds like a market opportunity to me.
Well, yeah, but it's a hard problem to solve. But the point is that I think, there's always another fashion retailer. There's not always, there are brands that, that we're going to be poorer for missing, but just didn't have a sustainable model. Today.
Again, that gets back to Sacker's point, which is, some of these businesses were just poorly run.
Yes.
And so
I hope we're not at peak consumerism or peak consumption. I that would be terrifying.
No, I hope not.
Yeah.
I don't think we're at peak consumption, but I do think that those brands were relatively unnecessary. Like, I don't need Abercrombie, and I don't need Limited. I can live without them.
But it's important to remember, we did consume more in 2007 than we do now. So we can't be at peak consumption, or even close to
it. Yeah. Well, I for one, wore more Abercrombie in 2007 than I do now. That's let's make that graph. Parting thoughts. this was really great. Parting thoughts, Brian.
Parting thoughts. One, I love having Sacco on the show. She's amazing. She can talk about a lot of different things, and it's VR, AR. Actually, on our way out, I would love to know if that thing that we had to bleep out of our last show is something we can actually talk about now.
Oh,
I don't know if she remembers.
Ask me that after the show.
That's great.
Okay.
Right. You didn't get a chance to, did you mention the Carlota Perez book that we had mentioned in the pre-show? Did you touch on that at all?
Oh, yeah. So it's this book called Technological Revolutions and Financial Capital. So it's something I read when I worked in VC. This is just another book, which is just this whole paradigm shift theory, that you have periods of incremental improvement and then periods of paradigm shift. And I guess the theory predicts that we are now in paradigm shift from the economy that was invented in the 20th century, which is all about cars, trucks, shipping containers, malls, and moving something which is about information technology, the internet, mobile. And I don't know, I think it's just a really interesting framing to kind of understand what's happening right now.
Interesting. Any parting thoughts, Saku?
Thanks for having me on the show. It's a really interesting podcast. It's great to talk about retail, all the stuff I didn't know.
Yeah. Thank you so much. And I don't really have anything useful to add other than to say we want your voice. And so thank you for listening. And we want you to give us feedback. So make sure to get that to us. You can reach us on social, Commerce Future on Twitter. And you can also reach us at futurecommerce.fm, and we're always available there. Start the conversation there, futurecommerce.fm on the discuss comment box at the bottom of the episode. Anyway, thank you for listening. And what's our sign off again, Brian? I forget.
Keep looking towards the future.
Oh, wow. We need a better one, but that'll do for now. Thank you, Saku.
All right. See ya.
Thanks.
Bye.